Hello, everyone. My name is Jerome Foster II, and I'm incredibly excited to be speaking with you all here today in Washington, D.C., which is my hometown. I haven't been here in a while, so, and just great to be here on a sunny day and to enjoy the great just weather here. To tell you a little bit about myself, I am a White House Environmental Justice Advisor. I'm a climate justice activist, and I'm a co-founder of the News to Impact organization, Wake Up, which is working to highlight the stories of marginalized communities to give them a platform to tell their stories to the wider world. I wanted to start with a little introduction of about when I was in ninth grade. It was when I remember I was walking and, no, I was biking through Southeast DC. I was on my slow mountain bike going through Southwest DC, just looking around, and I stumbled upon a dilapidated park, Banneker Circle. And I remember the exact moment. I was looking through the corridor, I was seeing how it could be used for solar panels, it can be used for wind turbines, could be used to really highlight the advances in renewable technology. And I remember I was thinking, I was like, how can I use this space in unique ways? How can I use this space to tell a unique story about environmental justice? But during that process, one idea was to clear some of the trees to install new trees that would look like that would look like trees, but would actually be wind turbines. And that was kind of a metaphor to what's happening today. Right now, we see companies and corporations on a larger scale prioritizing and using innovation, new technologies, and scale to say technology is the future, which it is. Technology is the future. But when we think about technology, it has to be coupled with environmental restoration and community involvement. That's the only way in which technology is also equitable in its implementation. I wanted to talk a little bit about my story. I'll go deeper into the connection between architecture and environmental justice later in my talk, but I wanted to talk more about how I got to this position in the White House and how I just started as a kid who just like loved tech. I guess I'm here. But I started in ninth grade again. I founded my virtuality organization called Tau VR, which was a civic-based virtuality organization which strive to get people from apathy to empathy, to understand why civic issues are so pressing and why they aren't just numbers. One of the first virtuality environments I created was called Crossing Borders, where I told a story of a five-year-old migrant traveling from Guatemala to southern Texas, telling the arduous 2,000-mile journey of that girl. You had a first-person perspective of their hardships and their triumphs. From exiting that experience, most people had a totally different perspective on immigration reform. And they were able to clearly understand the intersectionality between gender inequality, racial justice, and climate inaction. Just from that 30-minute experience of stepping in someone else's shoes and living what it's like to be on the front lines of the climate crisis. That's how I use technology. But what I realized is that some people that were experiencing my virtuality project not only went from apathy to empathy, but went from empathy to direct action. They started organizing their communities and said, hey, how can I actually make sure that I don't just know about this, but take action from it? So people started organizing. Youth started getting involved. It was still before the climate strikes, about 2 years before. It was Zero Hour, Sunrise Movement. It was a plethora of youth organizations that rose up and said, we need to be a part of this conversation as well. And from organizing there, one thing that led to the next, it was 10 young people that started climate striking. It was 30 young people, then 10,000, then 100,000, then 14 million young people on September 19th, 2019, demanding climate justice and holding elected officials accountable. It was us just posting on social media, on Instagram, thinking we might get some people to turn out, but it turned into a massive movement that changed how we even think about environmental sustainability. But during my process of going into activism, I realized that we also have to distill our demands into concrete changes, and that comes through policy. One of my first experiences in policy was in 2018 for the Clean Energy DC Act. It was actually one block away from here in the Wilson Building where I gave my first testimony. And I was in 10th grade at that time. And I sat there in a room full of lobbyists, full of people that just spewed greenwashing, more greenwashing, and more greenwashing. And I was there to represent the youth. There were a few of the organizers that were adults that were helping me prep. My dad was there helping me prep as well. And at the beginning, we walked into that conversation thinking no one's going to vote for this bill. Because why would they? This is before any youth movement. This is when climate, it's hard to even get one article to talk about climate change. Everyone just thinks it's about polar bears and not really understanding that's a justice and human rights issue. But after the 7 hours of testimony, we got it from thinking no one would vote to 50% of people would vote. 50% of the council split. And they said, we actually have to hear more. We want to hear more from people, more from the community. So we went there again tomorrow, another 7 hours. Much more greenwashing, much more lobbyists. But there are more youth. There are more experiences of people on the ground seeing how climate change is impacting their lives. And they told them blatantly that we will be the generation inheriting this inaction. From then, at the end, they deliberated for a few hours, 100%. Unanimously, they supported the Green Energy, Clean Energy DC Act, which transformed how Washington, DC was seen. It became one of the most renewable energy cities in the country at the time. And it continually made sure that renewable energy was first. And that fossil fuels was something you had to opt into, not the other way around. That is how us as young people used activism to change policy. And this is how we have to think about reframing how we interact with systems of governance. Right now, we always try to filter on the margins of change. We try to figure out how we can do 10 years of studying something and then making a marginal difference. That has to transform. We have one decade to take action. That's it. We have to be radical in our approach. So you have to rethink how we build, rethink how we even structure our cities, structure the urban environment. Because if we want to think radically, we have to build the environment around us radically as well. One way that I forgot to talk about was after I gave a testimony at the DC Council, I interned for Congress, for Congressman John Lewis, and I worked in climate policy there. Then afterwards, I started working in the White House with President Joe Biden. And from there, I worked on drafting executive orders, working on the Justice 40 initiative, which basically said that 40% of investment benefits must go to frontline communities and prioritizing their needs. We also work on creating an environmental justice screening tool, which is where we can use a tool to prioritize investment benefits in climate adaptation based on that tool. It's now been a year. We've had feedback from Congress. We've had feedback from communities. We've had countless numbers of public meetings. And we've realized is that policy is lacking because our design thinking is flawed. Right now, our structures focus on capitalism as the main lever of change. That we can use buyouts to manage, to oversee managed retreat. We can try to use market approaches to buy and sell carbon. But really what has to happen is to think about not just the economics of it, but think about the social repercussions of it. If we think about architecture, it's about three main things. It's about identity, community, and it's also about impact. It's about how do we inhabit these spaces. And the way that we rethink these things is not just by having community input at the beginning of it, but by reframing how we build entirely. We don't just come to the community with an idea. We come to the community to listen. We'd say, how can we be of support? And to then have those conversations spur new opportunities to create infrastructure. That's how we have to reframe how we think about building. I want us to think about one key way in which we think about climate justice right now. We're currently at the present, 2022. By 2030, we have to reach X amount of targets. And to get there, we have to think about the status quo and how we're going to adapt it to 2030 standards. That's what the mainstream everyone's thinking about. But What has to change is, why don't we look to the past and think about, for thousands upon thousands of years, humans have been living in harmony with nature. Indigenous and African communities lived with the principle of nature first, not economics first, but nature first. And that changed how they designed. They designed based on the needs of people and the of what they envisioned their environment to be. If you want a space that is community, that can be used for generations for that community, you have to build it modularly and you have to build it adaptably. Currently, architecture isn't like that. If you want to build something new, if you want to change it, destroy it, build something in the same place. That's fundamentally flawed, because in the next decade, we're going to have many new technologies emerging over and over and over again. And every time we have to change the foundation or change a key part of the building, have to tear it all down, we're not going to get anywhere. So we have to think about future-proofing our buildings from the very beginning, not as we evolve. The reason why I have these pictures up here is because I want to teach us three lessons about the past that we can use as we develop into the future. The first is of the Arobu community of the Ivory Coast, which is the top left. It shows that they use locally sourced materials. It's clay, sand, and animal byproduct that's used to actually be quite advanced for what it just looks like. It works incredibly well with nature. It has natural airflow going through it. It is water resistant. It is hard to catch on fire. It's so many things for the community. It's sourced locally. Right now, when we think about environmentalism, we often think about, do we want to use concrete or steel or wood or bamboo or some other technique that we can use? But it's still shipped around the world. That's still CO2 emissions that we aren't accounting for. That's that embodied carbon that we have to limit. When we think about the next decade, we have to think, what does this community already have within its roots? How can we think about working with that community and building from that? That's the first lesson. Next lesson that we should learn is, how do we make sure the conversation of permanency? A lot of buildings right now are testaments to 100 years ago, 200 years ago. They're still standing, but they don't quite work for the modern time. They're there, but not really helping anyone. They're just an eyesore, really. But what African communities did, especially on the Western coast, is that each generation would redefine all the old buildings and say, how can we update this for the next generation of people? How can we make sure that this is an iterative process in a stagnant community that after 40 years of non-maintenance becomes dilapidated? Second, that's the second principle. Third principle is what I mentioned before. But I want to think about not just the past, because the past wasn't all good. The past wasn't just humans living in harmony with nature. We had a dramatic shift with the early industrialization. That's when we severed our tie with nature. It was from that point on, we retreated from nature and ran to concrete jungles. We ran into job-centric communities where architects built homes close to the job site where it was unsafe, it was not good for their well-being, and it was great for technological process, but not great for the everyday life of the people, because parks were constantly destroyed, constantly not maintained, and led to people seeking to leave the city and going back to the farms that they came from. And that's a fundamental design problem in and of itself, because if we are actually building something that's for the community should like what they're in. They shouldn't be wanting to escape and constantly be like, oh, when I have X amount of money, we can go to this area away from this. We have to make sure that that is at the forefront of how we design. One thing that also changed in early industrialized communities is our reliance not just on money, but on exploitation of people. Because if you're constantly in an environment where work is the only priority, that continues the cycle of us overworking ourselves and not spending time in nature. But if we were to develop a solution to that, which is nature in itself, we could have more well-being, more better quality of life, and better communities in urban environments. One thing is that throughout the past and up into the present, that small little margin is what happened in the 70s to 80s to 2000s to now 2022, is that we become a car-centric society, especially in the United States. Some countries aren't that car-centric, but America has even further severed our tie from nature by making it impossible to just be in nature by happenstance, just to be in nature because that's what's around you. Right now, suburbia is community to store. Concrete, it's all you see. It's all that's around you. It's just endless amounts of concrete. And if you want to go to a store, the store has almost two times the space of its inward just being the parking lot. That doesn't give good quality of life. That gives the monotony of what cities did. They centered around jobs, they centered around mobility into the city, and they became city dependent. They didn't become their own small, tight-knit communities that were able to have their own culture in like a 15-minute city in a rural area. They would have to be dependent on New York City. Like Jersey City, a lot of times they are dependent on New York City for a lot of access to other things. Because we've allowed our communities to be car-centric and not public transportation-centric. One way in which we can change this is kind of my experience in London. I spent about 3 months in London, and it's a little town called Walthamstow, where you are basically on a streetcar. You're this streetcar-dependent community. And 5 minutes away is a movie theater, 3 minutes away is a grocery store, 2 minutes away is an apartment block. In America, that would be illegal. Single-family homes are the only thing that's possible. But architects can actually change this by using the power that they have as builders to demand change from government. If you want it to happen, you have the power. As youth, no one thought young people could mobilize in massive ways to make our voices heard. But you all have that same power. You just have to be brave enough to use it. And one way in which we can do that is by advocating for mixed-use development, by advocating for the inclusion of communities in every step of the process, and by making sure nature is interweaved into communities. But one thing that we have to be careful of is that investments don't turn into gentrification. A lot of our work over the past year in the White House has been making sure that we patch up a lot of the band-aids of government. Typically, before the council was created, the WEJAC, which is what we call the White House Environmental Justice Advisory Council, a lot of the grants that were given to communities that were at the front lines of the climate crisis were not given any of that money. It was often sent to rich communities or siphoned away through who knows what process. But that's systemic racism, systemic poverty, because even though we're trying to help, it doesn't. And even if it's successful, we fall into a bit of a trap. Because if our current model, if we build a park, a really up-to-date modern park, in a disadvantaged community at the front lines of climate change, and build a climate-adaptive infrastructure, what inadvertently happens is a rise in rent prices, which rises in displacement of communities, which leads to those communities leaving the area which we're trying to help. So, in effect, we did nothing. We just changed that community from one space, dispersed it out into another space. Gentrification destroyed that entire process. So we have to find ingenious ways in which we work with policymakers and communities. Say a rent freeze while we're building that process. Say other ingenious ways of using community involvement to actually make sure that we're helping communities and not just using clever marketing to say we did something. One thing I want to touch on is the fact that we are moving in the right direction now. In the past couple of years, we've seen a shift in how we think about environmentalism. We've seen in Paris how they have had a massive biking boom. They've had where bikes are basically in the middle of the road, not even on the sides of the road, to create a massive statement saying, you need to make sure that you're reliant on public transportation and not using so much carbon emissions for your own self. That's what has to happen here. we know that it might not work copy and paste because there's other layers of equity and diversity and racism that are embedded in America, so they're not the same communities, but they're similar theories of change. This is how we have to think about sustainability, is we may not have the perfect conditions to create the most utopian society or utopian architectural development, but we can use the existing infrastructure in ways no one ever expected them to. Like, no one ever expected Paris to make the middle part of the road to biking, because then car users are then sent a strong signal saying they can't do that anymore. We have to think like that in so many different ways in which we develop architecture. One thing to get at the root of this issue, to get at the deep root of this issue, is that architecture in itself has to change in how it teaches people. In order for us to be sustainable, we have to teach sustainable architecture practices, principles in schools. Just like how you know how to source materials or other skills that architects know, sustainability has to be one of them, because sustainability is just a part of our environment. Sustainability is how we interact with our environment. So it should know how what nature wants and how they want to use it. One way in which we can do this, to sum up the things that I brought up in this conversation, is to value connection with community. If I were to bring this all the way back to Banneker Circle and I was to rethink how I would develop it today, I wouldn't come with that same idea. I wouldn't come to the community thinking, I want to build this, do you agree? Or if not, you don't agree, can you tweak something slightly? I would go to them first saying, what ideas do you want? What historically has been neglected? And what in the future do you intend on seeing you'll need? And how can I be of support to that community? And through that, you'd have an entirely different vision of what the park could be. It could be educational. It could be anything that the community wants itself, not just a tourist attraction for people to come and take Instagram photos with. Next is the use of public-centric transportation, which I've already talked about a lot. And nature conservation is a huge role in how we have to, a huge change in how we have to build. Because based off of American Forest, there's been a tree equity score that was developed this year that showed that if we had more development of nature around these key infrastructure projects, it would increase our well-being by 3%, and it would increase our health just by having more trees. And the funny thing is that when we look at the tree equity score, it often follows patterns of race. It follows patterns of redlining. It follows patterns of sexism. The same old problems. Even though we spent decade after decade thinking we're trying to fix these problems, we aren't. We're only fiddling with the small band-aids on how to fix it. We at some point have to decide that we have to get to the root of these issues and be bold enough to fix them. The people in this room have the power to do that. We're in Washington, D.C. We're at the precipice of change. We're a democracy that allows us to do that. So use that power. And the last point I want to touch on is building adaptably. I can't stress this any more than how we build buildings has to change. We have to build it adaptably to each community. A house in Saudi Arabia, a house in Louisiana, and a house in New York City or Paris or Hong Kong shouldn't look the same. They shouldn't look like glass structures. They shouldn't look like glass boxes. They should be sourced directly from the community and reached out to every step of the way. That has to be driven home in so many of our business circles, in architecture circles. But now I want to ask you the question. What role are you going to play in creating a future, in creating a world that my generation wants to inhabit? I want to open it up to questions, to me, on any questions, comments, or concerns you'd like to have. It's an open dialogue.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes.
What made you want to do that? What made you want to get involved in that particular area?
Sure. I started out just by applying through seeing it online, because at first I saw that activism was becoming kind of performative if we don't have tangible, concrete ways in which we're implementing it in education and things like that. One thing I was advocating for was the passage of the Climate Change Education Act, because I had climate strike in front of the White House, and I wanted the inclusion of climate science for all and computer science for all. And one avenue I saw that doing that through is through joining the DC State Board of Education, where we retrofitted the high school graduation requirements for the class of 2030. They didn't listen to my recommendations. They're still in the notes section, but it was, at least they had to listen, so, yeah.
Hi, would you elaborate on your philosophy regarding gentrification? I've heard countless times that involving community members and collaborating helps to avoid that, but ideally you're still improving that area, which raises rent prices. So just how does involving the community members actually help reduce gentrification?
Absolutely. One way in which involving the community helps to reduce gentrification is in the installation of new projects, where if you're building a new home, you should have a plan on what you plan to maintain and how. Because the reason why it becomes in need of infrastructure investments is because of the lack of maintenance. Another thing that we can do is work more in tandem with policymakers, because we've seen, even the past couple weeks, we had a meeting with representatives from the people from the Housing and Urban Development, where they are looking for ways in which they can rethink their relationship with gentrification and green climate gentrification. I think we just have to have proposals that are meaningful enough for them to take interest in. Wow, if that's all the questions we have. Oh, perfect.
I really enjoyed your talk, but I'm curious if you could go a little deeper on the work with the EJ, the White House EJ group. What are the priorities you all are working on, and what do you think you're going to get done this year?
Yeah, absolutely. So we just got our report from last year, and we realized that a lot of our work has been centered around workforce development and also housing and urban development as well. A lot of what we try to prioritize is the aspects of that lack in the current system. Right now, we don't include race in a lot of conversations around climate justice. We don't include sex in a lot of conversations around climate justice either. And we don't really get to any of the root causes if we don't have that in the model. And another thing that we also try to prioritize is legacy pollution and making sure that we set plans for future technological advancements. So say the case study of carbon capture. A lot of carbon capture proposals to the Biden administration so far have only been for CO2 emissions, but haven't been for PM2.5 levels or other greenhouse gases that are also harmful for communities. So we look for those gaps in ways we can make impact and make, yeah.
So thank you very much. Thank you very much for your time. Thank you very much as a father of two young daughters. Thank you for what you're doing, first off and foremost. You're preaching to the converted here, right? We're already in the game. We want to do everything you're putting on the screen. In fact, we're actively trying to do it, most of the people in this room. How do you suggest, besides voting and besides trying to make the change, in our advocacy and our daily lives, how else can we old folk support the youth in making this transition into advocacy, into voting, into how do we help support you and give you the tools to do better than we did? Because we've tried and we're not doing that great a job. We need to do better. So how do you suggest we help?
Well, first I'll say definitely don't beat yourself up. There's over the past 10 years, there's been a lot more awareness around environmental justice. But I'd say one way in which you can support young people that are in the climate fight right now is one, through volunteering. We do need adult mentors in these spaces as well. Second is to donate if you have money to do that. But I think most of all, what's most important is that we give space for intergenerational dialogue. like creating spaces where it's not public. It doesn't have to be public like this. It could just be internal meetings where you get feedback from them and pivotal young people that are at the front lines or have experienced these issues or have knowledge in that. So I think that's some ways in which you can support. But I know there's some great organizations like 1 Million of Us, like Wake Up, like Earth Uprising, so many groups that have spaces for adults to also volunteer. Of course.
I'm curious what you learned from the iconic John Lewis that you're applying to your work today.
Yes, I interned for Congressman John Lewis in 2018, the first 5 months. Unfortunately, I didn't get to know him that well. I only met him once. But I learned from the culture of his office. It was just a space where you felt like you were getting into really in-depth discussions. I think I really understood the intersections between social issues when I was interning for him. Like, I knew that climate justice is intersectional with so many other issues, but I really understood it through that internship. Also, it impacted me just by knowing that movements aren't just fast. They're lifelong commitments, that we're in it for a long run. We do have a 10-year decade, and that the next decade has to have certain targets, but we're going to be in this fight till we're all here in gray hair and things like that. So we all got to be ready for that. And that's some of the lessons that I learned. So, yeah.
So I want to echo what Josh said, even though he took my question. and say thank you. One of the things that you said that was a bit of a wake-up call for me was that your generation is the one that's going to inherit our inactivity. And your generation is right there. Like, it's a 5-year, 10-year gap? It's right there. So that makes it a bit more real for me. You just mentioned targets, and so I wanted to ask you, if we're in a space where we're looking ahead and seeing what needs to be done now to achieve future targets, what targets do you identify that would be, what are the targets that you identify 10 years out from now?
Yeah, 10 years out from now, a lot of the targets are around our full supply chain. So for a lot of companies, they have to take accountability for their waste and create a system where it's circular in everything that they develop. Another target is that you have to be at bare minimum net zero by that time. That's the bare minimum. And also, it's not just thinking about net zero, but also thinking about water positive, like giving back to the community, and not just not harming nature, but actively helping nature and restoring nature to what it was before. And next target, I would say, is expanding our electrical grid, expanding the infrastructure to be even capable of harnessing that much renewable energy, and a lot of innovation around battery storage, because lithium-ion batteries aren't the best on storing renewable energy at the time, but we're seeing a lot of innovation on liquid metal hydride and other forms of energy storage as well. But I probably have like 50 other items. Those are my top ones, I guess. Sure.
Thank you for your time today. Just a quick question. Where have you and the administration found the most success reaching across the aisle, if any success?
Well, I kind of work in a different space. I'm in the federal side of things, so I don't really work with people that are on different sides of the aisle. But a lot of the conversations have been nowhere. Behind the scenes, I would have to say a lot of Republicans understand climate science. They understand that climate change is a pressing issue, but they're too scared of their voters finding out, which is weird. But I think that a lot of the success about reaching across the aisle has just been having conversations about nature. And just by improving nature, because that's the one thing Republicans do acknowledge, that we need more nature conservation. So,
thank you.
Great. Hi. Thank you so much for being here. And I guess I have the honor of asking the last question. So something that comes up a lot for me in green building is for somebody to say, well, what's the return on investment for making this commitment in sustainability? And I'm just thinking, when we're talking about communities and people's lives, there's a lot of things that people care about. And you touched about a lot of that in your talk. How can you convince people to think about that return on investment for making that commitment and that change in their lives when they've got competing priorities? And what experiences do you have with that?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest things about return on investment is thinking about long-term. That young people right now, my generation, prioritizes interacting with businesses that have morals. If they don't prioritize environmental justice, it's a complete non-interaction with that company, a boycott in a sense. A lot of my generation has sentiment that, and companies like Coca-Cola, Nike have seen that take effect in recent years. And I think that is one response to that. One thing, a return on investment, is that nature doesn't have to be a deficit. That I think nature in and of itself, just prioritizing nature in the long term is more durable to climate adaptation. So if you build a building that, sure, you can make some profit off of it, but gets destroyed in 5 years because you didn't do the proper regulations and didn't even think outside the box about climate resilience, then all your investment's gone. But if you, from the beginning, think about how that will work 50 years from now, or even just 15 years from now, you'll see that it actually makes some economic sense to put that investment up front.